Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 3, delivered on January 22nd, 2013. The title of this lecture is Money, Capital, and Interest Rates.
Today, money, capital, and interest rates. Okay, we live in caves. It's before the time when there was anything like civilization, you know, things like the internet and all of that. It was rough. But I am a hunter, and you are a maker of bread. I come to you, I just killed a moose. It's out there. You want to trade me for some bread? Okay? Well, now you like moose. Oh, who doesn't? I mean, really. And I like bread. So we make an exchange. 20 loaves of bread for one moose. I kept the antlers, you know, for decoration for the cave, you know, for the ladies. We go on our way. Question, was there any money involved in that at all, or was that just an exchange of goods? Was there any money in there at all? What do you think? No? It doesn't sound like money. Money's that stuff that you got in your pocket. Okay, here's the definition. Money is anything that is accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is accepted in exchange for something else. So that actually, something in there was money. We could say, well, the money was the moose or the money was the bread, but there was something in there that was money because we both agreed that we could have an exchange based upon this stuff. So the problem is that that doesn't sound too much like money, but in fact it is. You know, no. Okay, really? Yours? I don't know. Okay, let's start out with a couple of things, kinds of money. Now, the ancient, the oldest form of money would be what we would call barter money. Barter money. Now, I'll give you three different kinds of money here, and each of them has a characteristic that you can usually tell which of them it is. Barter money is money that can be used in exchange, but it can also be consumed as an asset. I could eat that moose, you could eat your bread, but instead we exchanged, so that has to be barter money because it is completely consumable, that kind of money is. The next kind of money is what we might call commodity or metal money. Although metal is not really a good term for it, because some of these monies were stone or things other than metal. There were even wood had been used. But commodity money is characterized by the fact that it is not as consumable. It is still consumable, but not as consumable. So I could take a piece of gold. That would be a commodity metal because I could use it. I could beat it into some pretty thing to hang on the mantle, or I could make a ring with it or something like that. So I could still use it as a consumable, but it wouldn't be quite as good in that. I'd have to work harder for it. But nevertheless, there's still a consumability to a commodity money. And throughout history, commodity monies have been fairly popular, although the idea that coins have been around since time immemorial, that's not really true. For the most part, even when there were coins in other eras, like in Rome and Greece and all of that. They were held by the wealthier people. The typical commoner still was in a world of barter money. In the ancient Egypt, the people who built the pyramids were not paid in money. They were in a commodity money. They were paid in a barter money. The skilled craftsmen, the builders. No, there weren't really that many slaves who built pyramids. It was all skilled craftsmen, mostly working in teams, that built the pyramids. And they lived in separate communities around the building site, and they were paid in food and wine and I'd say women, but that was how they were paid. So they were paid in barter. Commodity money does show up in Rome. It showed up in other ancient cultures. In Greece, there was commodity money. And it also showed up in the Middle Ages, too. Gold coins, silver coins, and the coins of other types. In fact, even in the United States, until 1964, there was commodity money. Our coins were made of silver. Our pennies, our dimes, our quarters, our half dollars were made of silver. So they were commodity money. They could actually, instead of being traded, they could be used. The last kind of money is fiat money, or some people pronounce it fiat money. But this fiat money is money that exists only by decree of a sovereign or of a great power. Fiat money has no intrinsic value of its own, or extraordinarily limited intrinsic value. Madam, what can you do with this? Yeah. Could you use it for something other than buying stuff?
Yeah, but...
you could use it to light a cigar or, you know, maybe toilet paper, but a paper airplane, origami, something like that. But really, it doesn't have hardly any value in and of itself. The only reason it has value is for the reason all money has value. People accept it. In this case, I can't turn this down. The sovereign has actually orders, and it says right here that this has to be accepted for all debts and trades. So that's the only reason this thing is used. It has no intrinsic value. It's not like a bread where I could eat it or accept it in trade. It's not like a gold coin where I could use it in trade or I could hammer it and make something cool out of it. This has no material value in and of itself, no intrinsic value. It has this value only because we are ordered to accept it. So that's fiat money. So those are the three kinds of money that are out there in the world. Now, money in the idea that it is a physical asset, no, it doesn't have to. And in fact, only in recent times, you have seen monies that don't even exist in the real world, electronic monies and all of that kind of stuff, but they are still there. Okay, the functions of money. Obviously, the first thing money does is it serves as a medium of exchange. It can be used so that we don't have to figure out how many loaves of bread equal one moose. We don't have to do it that way. We've got a base that we can all work from so that we have a commonality. The second one is a unit of accounting. Unit of accounting. In other words, we can keep track of our value. Yeah. You know what? Thank you for telling me that. Kind of washes out what I'm doing. Really? And that's really out of focus. Is it me? Am I having a small stroke or is that out of focus? There we go. I'm sorry, I yak my ass off and I don't even look at what's happening behind me. You know, there could be a zombie there and you guys just let it eat me or something.
Yep, he's going to get his ass kicked.
Okay, unit of accounting. And then finally, there is the store of value. Store of value. You see, I could keep that moose, but that moose would get old real fast and it would be really fetid, rotten. It would smell sort of like moose, you know. But if I have money, it doesn't waste away as fast. It can waste because of inflation, or also if you hold dollar bills, they can get old and rotten over time. But it has more of a store of value. You can hold the value in it for a period of time. So there you go. That's money at its heart. And I'm going to get back into it more deeply in the next lecture because, well, let me try it this way. Madam, do you like money? Okay, see, and I think that I would have most people say yes to that. And the idea there is that money is key to the functioning of a high-powered civilization because we need that ability to make one thing become another. And that's what money does. Money makes one thing become another. And I will remind you of that term liquidity. The efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity, the efficiency with which one asset can be converted to another. Dollar bills are extraordinarily liquid. You can immediately turn dollars into a cheeseburger and fries. But at the same time, a house has an incredible amount of value, but it is not liquid. You cannot immediately convert it into something else. This is important to know because this is at the heart of the credit crisis that nearly brought the world to its knees about 5 years ago. Because you see, ultimately, if we don't have liquidity, at least some, then we can't do business. We can't function. And the problem is that there were banks, many banks that had huge amounts of value, but they didn't have liquidity. And a large part of that was because the Federal Reserve stopped printing money, the kind that we use. It was, so we had this rapid growth of these kinds of money that were not liquid, but we didn't have growth of the kind of money that we use in everyday transactions. And so in order to correct for that, well, first of all, at the level of people, you and me, and small businesses, like the one I run or like a lot of small businesses, millions in the country, we need money to be able to transact. It was slowly dying away for a period of about 4 years. And sure enough, eventually that was beginning to cause some serious problems. The other part of it was that very large banks, and even smaller banks, they had huge amounts of value, but they didn't have liquidity. So they didn't have the money to pay the everyday bills, so they started using these massive assets that were illiquid as backing for extraordinarily risky instruments. So that essentially they were writing side bets to gain liquidity off huge assets behind them, and sooner or later that's going to come down and kick us in the ass, and it caused an incredible problem that has never been resolved. We've covered it up pretty well, and we'll go on for a long time, but the underlying problem of all of that stuff that was out there never really got corrected, and I'll talk about that in the next lecture. But for now, now, when I say markets, I'm using it in a term that's actually a little different from how it would be used in an economic sense. But you got $20 I could borrow? What the heck? You know, really? Fine. Five? Okay, fine, thank God. And I'll pay you back for it in just a couple of weeks, as soon as I get a paycheck, you know. Like, I'll pay you back. No, I'll pay you back in a couple of weeks. When I talk about short-term movements of money. We actually call that the money market, where those kinds of transactions happen. The money markets. When you buy a burger, that's in the money market. When you borrow money for 90 days, that's in the money market. When you lend money for a short amount of time, that's in the money market. If you buy a treasury bill that is less than a year, that transaction occurs in the money market. So the money market is the market for short-term borrowings. And I think I mentioned this already, but I'm going to bring it up again. When companies want to borrow money, there are different reasons they would. One would be for big, massive projects. There's this company just announced today that it is going to actually start building a fleet of asteroid mining vehicles to set up on the asteroids and start to do the mining on with colonies working on the asteroids. That would be a very long-term investment that would be huge. So they would borrow billions of dollars, and it would be paid back over a period of 20, 30, 50 years. That's actually an extreme example of what companies usually do when they want to do big projects. They borrow money for a long time. When you want to buy a house, someday you're going to actually own a house. Well, maybe you do already. Do you own a house? Okay. That was a long-term purchase, and you borrowed money for it? Yeah, so that would be a big investment. We call that a capital investment. But if you're a company, that's not the only reason you might need money. Have you ever been on short on money at the end of a month? You ever run out of money? I do every month. Hell, I run out of money about the third day, fourth day of the month. So you need money. Companies are the same way. Sometimes they need money just for a short period of time, 30 days, 90 days, 180 days. That is in the money market that they would borrow money on a short-term basis. If they borrow money on a long-term basis or any kind of a flow of money that occurs in a long-term kind of way, that's called a capital market. Now, in the money market, this is an extraordinarily active, vital market. At the high end, large creditworthy corporations borrow money for very short periods of time just to get through a period when they need some quick cash or because cash flow is low for a short period of time. One of the ways that they do that is through what is called commercial paper. Commercial paper is issued for very short periods of time by large creditworthy corporations that just need money for a couple of weeks or a couple of months. The typical commercial paper is a 30-day instrument, and it literally looks sort of like an IOU. It's that simple. And this is a vital market. Huge people who've got a ton of money, institutions, they'll put it up for 30 days for a little bit of money, and then they'll then the company will pay it off in 30 days. But again, this commercial paper is issued only by large creditworthy corporations, so it's very safe. Unfortunately, it's not perfectly safe. There have been examples of companies that were large, reputable, creditworthy, who pumped out commercial paper and died within weeks of pumping it out. They knew damn well what they were up to, and they just defaulted like a boss on that paper. Great example of that would have been Enron. In its last dying weeks, they were pumped out commercial paper, and of course they knew darn well they were going to die. They just needed to cover their asses for a couple more weeks so that the big dogs could get their money out into the islands. And so they borrowed money in these money markets on commercial paper, and then they just walked away from it when finally the crap hit the fan. So it's not perfectly safe, but it's usually pretty safe. I'm going to come back to this in just a minute, commercial paper and things like that. Now, capital markets, I mean, they're all over the place, but I mean, the bond and stock markets are in the capital markets because those flows of funds are long term. Stock is forever, for one thing. Bonds, 10, 20, 30 years. So that is capital market transactions. Now, let me think here. How do I want to go with this? There are two directions that I should go here. I'm trying to think. Let me remind you of debt and equity, just to make sure you remember these. Debt is company borrowing money, and then it pays it back based upon terms and conditions. When a company issues debt, that is basically borrowing money from the lenders. The lenders buy the debt bonds, and thereby they become the lenders to the corporation. They have to be paid back first. They have to be paid back first in a timely manner. If there's an interest payment due, they have to get it. If there is a retirement of the face value, they have to get it. Equity represents ownership. These are the people who buy stock, and they become forever the owners of the corporation until they sell their stock to someone else. But if you buy stock in Facebook or something like that in a primary offering, that means that you are then an owner of the corporation. A minuscule tiny owner probably, but you still are an owner. You get residual claim. So the debt holders have the prior claim to cash flow. The equity holders, if there's anything left after the debt holders have gotten theirs in the order, in the timing that they're supposed to, then the stockholders can say, okay, we get some dividends, or the company can plow the profits back into the company, and then hopefully the people will have their stock price go up. Debt is not one thing, though. There are all kinds of debt. Like I said, companies can borrow debt short-term in the money market. They can generate money that way. Or if it's long-term, they can borrow, get money out of the capital markets. But debt, there are all kinds of debt. I'll give you a great example. Let's try this. I am a big institutional investor. I have lent this corporation $100 million. You are a customer of this corporation. You just ordered, what did you just order? A jacuzzi, okay? And so you paid them $2,000 for it, and you on a debit card, and so they've got your money, they've got my money. And then they can't pay. You go belly up. You don't have enough money to pay me my interest payment. Okay, now you understand that you and I are both debt holders. You owe each of us something. You owe me my interest and my principal. You owe him a jacuzzi. We're both debt holders. You're a debt holder on a short-term instrument. Okay, I'm a debt holder on a long-term instrument. Let's try this. Which one of us would be satisfied first? We're going to liquidate your ass. We're going to just take you to the cleaner. Okay, no negotiation. We're just going to sell everything you've got, and we're going to get our money. Okay, now there's probably not going to be enough money to go around. Who gets first, me or you? Yep. You probably will never see your stuff because I am allowed to sell you the inventory. You won't even see that jacuzzi because I'll sell it to someone else. You'll lose out. That's one of the problems with debt. You can lose. But it's not as bad as with stockholders because at least you and I can both sue this corporation to liquidate it. Stockholder can't do anything. Stockholder is stuck. Stockholder will essentially be wiped out. There's nothing left. Okay. Now, that gets me out of that issue. Primary versus secondary. Now, you notice what's going on here. I'm giving you a lot of terminology right now, just terminology. And then I can get, once I got the terminology laid in, I'll just keep talking and we'll discussing, and you'll be able to get more comfortable with using this terminology. primary you've decided that you want to be a stock kind of guy. You want to be a day trader. You're going to sit at a computer in your home with a giant bag of Cheetos and eat those Cheetos and buy and sell stock all day long. That's what, how you're going to work. You are a 48-year-old who works in a cubicle for a big mega corporation, and you have a 401k. And it allows you to do some of the investment yourself. You can buy and sell stocks. Okay. Now, here's the thing about the two of you. Most likely, you two are going to have stocks, trade stocks. You for through your money manager in your company. You for your own part. Most likely in a secondary market. That means that the stock that is being traded, the company sold a long time ago or some time ago, and now it's bouncing around between buyers and sellers. The company really doesn't care much about, well, it does, but the company has nothing really to say about it. This is just private transactions. You decide that you want to load yourself up with some Microsoft. You've got Microsoft to sell. Well, it might end up that you get his Microsoft stock. There's no Microsoft involved. It's just a pure transaction between a buyer and a seller. That's the secondary market, where most of you will be. The primary market, although you might be able to participate in it, don't. I mean, seriously, don't. The primary market is where companies actually sell from their registration statements what they've got. Yeah. You know, what is it? I don't want to turn it off because I don't want to hurt its feelings. But, you know, after a while, wait a minute, what is it saying? Press something to permanently mute. I don't have to listen to you. You're not my real dad. Don't tell me what to do. Oh, what? Where the hell was I? Primary versus secondary. Okay, the primary market is where a company sells stock or bonds and the money goes to the company. So Facebook would, through its underwriting syndicate, sell a whole pile of shares of its common stock to buyers. And then the buyers, that money would go, a little bit of it would go to the investment bankers, and then the rest of it would go to Facebook to finance its operations. That would be primary market. When the company receives proceeds, net of brokerage fees, for its issue of bonds or stock. That's a primary market. If you're just buying bonds or stocks on ticker symbols running and calling your broker and all that kind of stuff, that's secondary market transaction. Primary market. You're talking about transactions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, tens of millions at the small end. These primary market transactions are carried out usually through investment bankers representing the companies that need the money. And those, the people, well, the entities that buy this kind of stuff, the stocks and bonds that are issued by the company, those are massive institutional investors. Brokerage houses buy it themselves and then they sell it out after they've bought it. Extremely rich people. Trust funds, insurance companies, other corporations that want to have an interest, acquire an interest, buy into these. This is not a place where beginners start. Primary market transactions are very much the world of extraordinary money, where the problem is that oftentimes what will happen in a primary market transaction is that a broker will get an allocation from an offering. All right, you're going to sell this much of the stock. You're going to sell this much. It's called a syndicate, an underwriting syndicate. So you're a broker. I'm a broker sitting there. The first thing that happens is that we're going to sell the stock to right away to very rich people, to big institutions. and that's going to push the price up as we sell this off. Boy, there's a lot of demand for it. Price starts going up. Now, within a very short period of time, those people are going to want to unload some of that because they're going to overbuy, and we gave it to them at a discount. So what I then have to do is start calling suckers like you and say, all right, here we go. I have got the deal of the century. We've still got some of this Facebook stock left, and you know, you seem to be the kind of savvy person that would really be able to handle this kind of thing. So here you go. You want to buy into it, or are you a wuss? You want to buy? What do you want? 100 shares? Really? You want 1,000? I mean, this is Facebook, man. You've seen Zuckerberg. Yeah, he's a weenie, but what the hell? Yo, buy. See, so what will happen is that the primary transaction came to the broker, and the broker bought it. And then the broker, first secondary leg, he sells it off to the institution, to the rich. And then once we pump the price up like that, then we're going to start uncorking it as the price goes down. We're going to sell it to you. Price will drop. We'll sell it to you, you poor sucker. Price will drop some more. By the end, we've cleared our inventory, and we can just sit back and say, yeah, we got it done. So the primary leg was that the brokers themselves, the underwriting syndicate, bought the stock, and then the first secondary transaction would be that we would sell it to the wealthy, and then from there we would sell it down the line to the losers who thought they were getting in on something great and all that. It's primary versus secondary market. You won't be allowed to be in the primary market. Even if you heard, well, the day after Facebook was issued, you have a chance to buy some. That wasn't a primary market transaction because that was already bought, and then it's being bought. The company, Facebook, got its money. And so what's happening after that, anything that happens after that, is secondary market action. You got the idea of how secondary versus primary works? You won't get to be in the primary market, I don't think, ever, unless you get into real heavy brokering, investment banking. Now, getting all of that off the table. Give me just a split second here. I want to check something. Should I remember that? No, well, I'll be darned. Yeah, I did. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm trying to think of someone. Have you ever heard of a singer named Barry Manilow?
Yeah.
Okay. It was a long time ago. He had this song. It was called Ships in the Night. We're two ships that pass in the night. We both smile and say it's all right, but we're just two ships passing in the night. Okay. Call me later. Okay. See, you didn't have any money for me, so I don't like you, you know? She was going to give me $5. That's $5. That is the $4 Grand Slam at Denny's and enough for coffee. You'll have to pay for your own, okay? Okay, but you see, what happens is that we transact. There are people who have money, and there are people who need money. There are companies and institutions that have money. There are companies and institutions that need money. If you have money, we call you a surplus economic. Really, can I spell today? Economic agent. You're a surplus economic agent. If you have money. If you need money, we call you a deficit economic agent or unit. Call it a unit, maybe. Sometimes you'll hear me say agent, sometimes unit here. But now there has to be a way for these people who have surplus to meet up with the people who have deficit. But the first question is this. There's a simple question. If I've got tons of money, I'm a surplus economic unit, why would I want to meet a deficit economic unit? Why would you want to meet me if I need money? You have money. Why would you want to meet me? Is there any reason? Very good. Because if you just sit, or you put all your money in your mattress, and just, I got money under my bed. No, it's not gonna do anything for you. It's not gonna earn you anything. It will erode. What happens if that bed catches on fire, for God's sake? You know? Yeah, you're dead. So it would be better if you were making that money work. And the harder it works for you, the better. So there's a reason for you to want to meet me. I obviously have a reason to meet you. I mean, that's why I meet girls all the time, because they got money, you know, really. Hell with dating them. But you see, here's the idea, is that I obviously have a need as a deficit unit. But you have every bit as much interest in this deal as I do. Because if you don't meet me, what are you going to do with your money? Just sit there on it all that time? So there is incentive on both sides of this transaction for these two to meet. Instead of being like two ships that pass in the night, we've got to find some way that we can hook these two together. The process by which surplus and deficit economic agents are brought together is called financial intermediation. Financial intermediation. Now, I'm going to give you a warning here. I asked this one as an essay question on the first test. Okay, right now, there's going to be a question on the first test. One answer, one sentence. What's financial intermediation? Don't say it's when banks, or say anything like that. It's when banks, or it's when lending institutions. No. They can be financial intermediators, but they don't have to be. You can meet people on the street. You can ask your mom and dad. You can talk to a friend. There's still financial intermediation going on. It's not necessarily institutionalized, although culturally a lot of these mechanisms are. But financial intermediation is simply the bringing together of surplus and deficit economic units. That's all it is. Banks and other types of financial institutions are specialists in it, but they take their own cut in these deals. So, for example, if you are going to, you've got a lot of money, you can put it into a bank, then that bank can lend a part of that out to other people. So they serve as the go-between. But they'll take a cut of that along the way, obviously, to do that kind of go-between status. Now, here's the problem, though. Bringing together financial, the surplus and deficit economic agents is a little more a lot more nuanced. Because, you see, woman, I need $10 million. You got it? The hell, man, you know? You! $10 million. Okay, $10,000. Whatever, you know, ten. $1,000? $100? Okay, but you see, there's the problem. First of all, do you have any money in your pocket at all? No. Do you even lift? <You know. laughs> Okay, what the hell? You got any money in your pocket?
Yeah.
Okay, how much? No, don't. Someone will rob you. No, never mind. Okay, look. But you see, it's probably not $10 million, right? Okay, so he is a surplus economic unit, but he wouldn't have enough to lend someone $10 million. So there's the first thing that we have to take into consideration in a financial intermediation is the level. In other words, the amount. Some surplus units have big bucks, some surplus units have small bucks. $5, you said? $5? Okay. Payback in a week. Okay, how about 5 years? 20 years. Dude, I'll be dead. You know? So I won't have to worry about it. See, there's the other thing. Some units would be willing to lend at for a certain amount of time. Other units, surplus units, would be willing to move money at a longer time. You probably need $5 by the end of the week. But there would be some institution that wouldn't need $5 back for years. So there's the second one, timing. Timing would also have to be taken into consideration. The level has to be taken into consideration. The timing has to be taken into consideration. Because there will be different needs. I might be able to pay back in a year, but there might be someone who could lend me money, but they wouldn't be able to stand a year. They'd want it back within a month. But someone else might be willing to take a year. There might be someone who say, well, yeah, I'll lend it to you, but I don't want it back in a year. I'd want it back in 20 years. So the timing would have to match. And then there's another one, too. The last one has to do with risk. You see, some people are willing to put money in to something very risky. Roll the dice. Other people are going to say, no. No, I want something that's kind of like a safe investment. You look, you'll be second on this one. You look very young. I mean, you're a fine, upstanding stud. Very young, okay? And when you're young, you can take risks with your money. Because even if you get your clock cleaned, technically what we say, you take an ass bath, you would, you'd be able to climb back up from that, you know, in the time before you retire. You, on the other hand, looking like you're about my age, I'm in better shape, but... would you take a big, big risk on your retirement money? You do. Are you nuts? Oh, okay. Most people would not, though. Because if they're approaching retirement, they're thinking about how having the money so that they can buy their Metamucil and all of the other things that make them go to the toilet. But the problem there is that they cannot take risks. If they want certain fixed income into their retirement, they're not going to be high risk takers like a younger person is, because they won't have time to recover if everything goes south on them in their investments. So there is that risk that is in there too. There are some, as I told you before, that in this world there are crazy mofos. They love risk. In the world of finance, they are all over. We know where they are. They will eat risk. They love it. And then there are those who don't want risk. They just don't want it. Either because they are risk averse or because of the rules that govern their asset management. Give an example of that. A company here in town, they'll be speaking at the Illinois State Students in Finance. Some of them will next week on Monday night. They're asset managers with a company here in town, wealth asset managers. In other words, they take rich people's money and they invest it. Now, with this kind of an asset management company, they are by the rules not allowed to roll the dice hard. They have to buy very safe instruments, bonds, things like that, that don't have much risk in them, just by the rules. So you would say that they are the kind of people who deal in money with a risk factor that is very low. They take these people's money. They take the money of surplus economic units, and then they match it with deficit economic units based upon a very low risk. What's the problem with that, though, with that low-risk approach? How do you think those wealthy people, what do you think they think about it with that low risk? You got an idea of how?
Probably less return.
Oh, not probably, definitely. I mean, they're talking about, you got someone like puts $1 million into one of these wealth asset management funds years ago, 10% return. You lived on $100,000 a year. Now, with the risk, with the lower risk and the lower expected return, they're lucky if $1 million generates $20,000, $30,000 a year for them in the current economic environment, which will probably stay that way for a very, very long time. So the idea, well, I'm going to retire and I'm a millionaire, everything's going to be okay. Oh no, you're going to eat cat food. With $1 million going into your retirement, the best wealth asset managers aren't going to be able to help you out very much at all. Now, 20 grand is okay. I mean, you know, you get the right kind of cat food. You don't buy the fancy feast, you know, obviously. You go more with, you know, Alpo for cats or something. But the thing, though, is you see, that's that risk factor coming in. There's surplus economic units operating through an agent for them who are providing money to deficit economic units. But the risk that they are willing to bear is very, very low on that. On the other hand, you have venture capitalists who will fund projects, put in a lot of money. They'll take a hell of an equity stake in them. But they will, they know, okay, this is extremely risky. We're going to throw money into it anyway because we love our self-risk. That's what we do, is we throw money at very high-risk projects, knowing very well that we could get beaten to death on them. But at the same time, if they come through, we are a great big winner. So that's the three parts that are required for the matching. Matching the surplus and deficit economic units requires all three of these. One last thing before I leave this. The part where you have a little money to lend, right? Sure, you do. Don't lie to me. I know what's in your pocket. Yeah. But the thing, though, is that you also borrow money, right? You need money. So it's interesting because you can find that a surplus economic unit is also a deficit economic unit. It's based upon different profiles of the level, timing, and risk. So you'll see a company that will have tons of cash, but it'll still borrow money for projects, or it'll still issue stock. You'll see people who have lots and lots of hard, big assets, but they don't have money to pay their bills, so they will be deficit economic units at the same time that they're lending money to other corporations or to giving it to banks to lend out at another in another realm of the capital markets. So you can be both a surplus and a deficit economic unit at the same time. As a matter of fact, most people are. Give you an idea of this. If you go to work for a corporation, you'll probably be in a 401k. You'll be putting money into this throughout your productive employed life. And so as such, you are part of a pool of surplus economic value. But at the same time, you're going to borrow to buy a house. You're going to, well, a trailer maybe in Peoria. But you're going to borrow for a lot of things. And so there you are. You're going to stand there, I am a surplus economic unit, and at the same time, I am a deficit economic unit. And in fact, the two profiles are surprisingly similar. Risk, timing, and level. Well, they're actually quite similar, but the nuance of them allows us to separate your surplus value from your deficit value, and we can service both of them. But again, financial intermediation isn't just for banks. It's there again, isn't it? Ha! Bite me. Okay, this takes us to this thing. On the first exam, I oftentimes will ask you, what is the relationship between risk and return? Now, you could say the greater the risk, the greater the return, in which case I would take off about half the points because it's not return, it's expected. As I told you in the last lecture, there is no guarantee except with certain types of sovereign instruments, but other than that, it's expected return, not actual return. So the rule is the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. But it's actually even deeper than that, this concept is. Because risk has two pieces to it. There's risk that you don't have to take. That's called diversifiable risk. No one's going to reward you for that. You shouldn't expect a reward for it because you're stupid to have it. And then there is another kind of risk that you can't get rid of, non-diversifiable. That's the risk that you can't get rid of. That's a risk for which you should expect a return. So the rule would be the greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. By the way, there's another term for this. Non-diversifiable risk, you'll hear me use the term systematic. Systematic. It's in the system. You can't get it out. It's the life force of this thing. And then the diversifiable risk is what we call non-systematic. It's not part of the system. It's something that you should be able to wipe out. So you could say the greater the systematic risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk that is in the system that you can't get rid of, that you are actually bearing so that you can get something. That's what you should expect a return for. I'm going to tell you a bad story now. I'm going to show you your life. And specifically, the cost of your health care. Now, you're born here. We won't include before you were born. And there was a kind of an expense in there, pretty expensive. You were kind of a sickly kid. We thought about leaving you, but, you know. And then after the birth and the natal stuff, your cost goes down. Then you have diarrhea. It goes back up. And it goes back down. And then you have a few childhood illnesses, and we get you some vaccinations, and there's these colds and flu we gotta take care of. Then you're about 7, you break your ass for the first time on a bike, and it goes down. Then you're 12, and we catch you with, we get a call from the police that you're twitching because you found what blow is. And we get you in rehab, and you're okay. You get real emo. Did you hear about the new emo brand pizza? It cuts itself.
That ain't funny, man.
And you get your shit together and you're okay. And you're in your 20s. And this is when you're at your healthiest, which should scare the hell out of most of you. You're at your healthiest. You're cruising along, no problems. And then you get into your 30s. You're starting to get that pot belly. Starting to have a few problems with your prostate. Have your first heart attack at 40. Start buying Viagra. Get diabetes. High cholesterol. Then you get your shit together for a few years. Then you have a stroke. And you say, go Cubbies. Sorry. It gets worse and worse. We have to put tubes in you so you don't pee all over. And then you die. Which is good because we're getting sick of you bitching. Well, that kind of sucks because, you see, the problem here would be that over a period of time, you're earning money and everything's going along pretty well. But there comes a point where you hit some of these and you can't afford them. You're ruined. So your life doesn't go on. You know, we throw you out of the hospital and you die on the street. So you see, that kind of sucks. But there are also these troughs. And I'm going to go through you. I'm going to tell about your life now. Born about the same time, you were a very healthy person. Every kid, you know, you were doing pretty good. Very few illnesses. Then you have, you know, really great kid. And then you get possessed by a devil, and we have to get some stuff done for you. And then we get over that, and your health care goes down. And you get into your 30s, and then you start having bowel problems. And then you have cancer. But you keep on living, and you're fairly healthy. And you die later. Women die later. Pisses me off. Well, no, it doesn't. If I die first, at least I don't hear the bitching anymore. Okay. You hit a ruin point. Notice what's happening, though. You see, these are not perfectly the same. So they don't perfectly add up. They partially actually cancel each other out. If I were to put more and more and more of these in here, younger kids, older people, something interesting would happen to the total cost of the system. What would happen is if I put in enough people into this chart, young, old, middle age, all over the place, I would see that everyone is canceling each other out as far as ups and down goes, and there's actually a hum of cost. It's there. It's not like they cancel out each other's complete cost. Obviously not. But what they do is they get rid of each of the individual peculiarities. If I put enough people in there and they're not perfectly correlated with each other, in other words, they're not all going at the same time, doing the same exact thing, they will cancel out each other's variability, and underneath, we will see that there was an overall very stable cost of the entire population. That's insurance. See, because once I have an actuarial understanding of what that underlying hum of cost is, I can just charge you a premium. Everyone join in. I'll charge you a premium plus a little bit to manage this thing. And then when you get sick, I pay for it. That's how it works, you see. That's how insurance works, because essentially you are no longer at risk of being ruined because you are participating in a pool with everyone else. Sometimes people are having heart attacks while other people are feeling great. You're old, it's costing a lot for you, but we've also got these 20-year-olds in here who aren't demanding on the system that are covering you. Then when their higher cost health care years come in, there'll be younger people in the pool that will be able to handle them. That is the principle of insurance, but it's also the principle of stocks. Because you see, each and every stock has all of this volatility, risk, up and down and up and down. But a strange thing happens. As if you hold one stock, you're on a whipsaw, just an insane roller coaster ride. I don't care what you buy, safe stock, risky stock, the volatility will make your nose bleed. The price going up and down every day, boom, 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 boom. But if you put two stocks together and look at the total price volatility, the price volatility goes down of the total portfolio. 5 stocks? 10 stocks? 20 stocks? 30 stocks? 50 stocks? As long as you hold them so that each one in your portfolio has approximately the same weight the company does in the entire economy, lo and behold, the diversifiable risk goes away. And all that remains is the risk of the system itself, the non-diversifiable risk, the risk that cannot be removed no matter how many stocks you put in your portfolio. That's what remains. Truth of the matter is, you get to 30 stocks, you've shaken out almost 95% of the diversifiable risk. 30 stocks. In fact, you can buy mutual funds and ETFs, and I'll talk about those in the next lecture, that essentially they are already diversified portfolios, and then you buy a share of that to get rid of the risk. But the bottom line is, though, that this is what I meant up here when I was bitching about non-diversifiable risk. That's this underlying hum right here. See it? That's that hum right there. That green really isn't showing very well. Okay. So, get these people to say, well, I got a tip on some stock in this company, and so I'm going to buy it because it's going to be a winner. You're the dumbest ass in the world if you buy that crap, because you're buying all of this massive diversifiable risk that you're not going to get a reward for, because you're holding one stock you've thrown on a side bet, and lo and behold, guess what? You're going to see that volatility going up and down every day. You're not going to get any reward for it. It's because it is diversifiable risk. You don't have to hold it. No market is going to even try to give you a reward for it. Because all you'd have to do is have a diversified portfolio, and all of that massive individual stock risk, it's not there. Why would you expect a reward from these for something that you don't have to take on? So that gives you an idea of how we think in finance. This idea, buy a stock that's really, you heard a hot tip on. These idiots on television like Cramer on CNBC and all these other financial gurus, they make their money by trying to get you to be suckers. Don't do it. Just buy into a diversified portfolio, and then you've gotten rid of the risk that you shouldn't have expected a reward for anyway. Principle of risk diversification. It's all over the world. Insurance deals in risk diversification, stocks, investments deal in risk diversification. That's the whole idea. Even companies, to a certain extent, and this is a debatable, it's actually a part, it's a hot topic, it never goes away. The companies, we see companies take on projects that aren't in their core competence. Why are you doing that? The theory that we have and is that they are attempting portfolio diversification, wherein their products, each of their products is like a stock. And the more products they have, the wider their diversification of risk becomes, because if one is going down, the other is going up. So we would see companies trying to diversify their product lines, their brand lines, their co-branding opportunities, even their markets that they're selling in, target of demographics that they're after, just because they're trying to diversify their portfolio, just like a good stock investor or an insurance company would as well. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.